If you like what you're hearing on the Security Ledger podcast, consider subscribing to one of our newsletters like the Daily Ledger or the Weekly Ledger. You can learn more and sign up at securityledger.com/subscribe. This is the Security Ledger podcast, and I'm Paul Roberts, the editor-in-chief at the Security Ledger. In this week's podcast, episode number 149...
To argue at this point that the success of Huawei is not intimately involved with the success of some, you know, Chinese foreign policy goals at this point, it just doesn't measure up anymore.
As the trade war between the U.S. and China heats up, one company has become the poster child for the crumbling trust between Beijing and Washington. That company is Huawei Technologies, a Shenzhen maker of everything from networking equipment to smartphones. With over $100 billion in sales and 180,000 employees globally, Huawei has become a key participant in China's ambitious Belt and Road Initiative to develop and modernize a broad swath of Africa, Asia, and Europe. But Western doubts about Huawei's intentions are nothing new. Silicon Valley competitors and defense and intelligence experts have long warned about the ties between Huawei, the Chinese People's Liberation Army, and the Chinese Communist Party. The Trump administration has ratcheted up pressure on Huawei, warning U.S. government agencies not to use the company's technology and warning those that do business with the U.S. government to beware. China's government has retaliated, warning U.S. and Western firms about the dangers of participating in Washington's ban. That leaves businesses in a pinch, but our guest this week suggests that they may do well to be wary of Huawei, regardless of what the U.S. government and the Trump administration says. Priscilla Moriucci is the Director of Strategic Threat Development at Recorded Future. In a report released this week, Recorded Future said that Huawei's risk to Western companies and Western values is unique because of the breadth of its technology portfolio and, by extension, of the data that it harvests and mines from customers worldwide. That data could prove irresistible to a Communist Party interested in lifting China's stature as a global superpower and wary of democratic values like free expression and freedom of association, Moriucci says. In this conversation, Priscilla and I talk about the new Recorded Future report about the ongoing dispute between U.S. and China over Huawei and about what companies caught in the middle should do.
Priscilla Moriucci, I'm the head of Nation State Research at Recorded Future.
Priscilla, welcome back to Security Ledger Podcast.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks for having me.
It's always a pleasure to have you. So Recorded Future today, we're talking on Monday, put out a really interesting report on the Chinese IT vendor Huawei, who has been the subject of a tremendous amount of news, sanctions, applied sanctions from the U.S. government, a lot of hemming and hawing about whether Huawei in and of itself, its technology poses a security and an intelligence risk to the U.S. and its allies. And your report basically says you should probably think twice about using Huawei. Talk a little bit about how you came to write this report and at a high level, kind of what you guys found in the course of putting this research together.
Sure. So, you know, I think as, you know, many people who kind of are researchers, right, who specialize in looking at, you know, Asian cyber threats, you know, we get a lot of questions and we have been for, you know, a while now, about, you know, hardware technology and service providers, and particularly Huawei, right? Even before, you know, a lot of this confrontation, you know, started with the Trump administration. So we've sort of been talking about it for a while. And from my perspective, I've always tried to paint the picture, right, when I talk about Huawei, that it's not necessarily the threats and the risk, right, from Huawei are not about 5G technology, right, or services in and of themselves, right, but it's a much larger geopolitical aggregate risk in using Huawei technologies, right? And so sort of got prompted and tried to put the whole argument actually on paper.
This conversation has been going on for a while. In fact, back around the turn of the millennium in 2000, I worked for Cisco Systems. And even back then, Huawei, which was a fairly obscure but up-and-coming competitor to Cisco's, Chinese competitor to Cisco's, was the subject of a lot of consternation. There was this feeling that they were stealing Cisco's intellectual property and turning it into their own knockoff products. Yeah. And then certainly since the Trump administration has come in, there's been a real ratcheting up of the conversation to really specifically mention Huawei and their technology and just, you know, say in not unsubtle terms to Western companies, you know, this technology poses a real risk to your organization. Is that just a reflection of just a change in administrations and geopolitical shifts, or has the threat itself increased over that time period?
So I think it's a combination of both, right? So over that period of time, right, Huawei has moved significantly from being, you know, as you sort of framed, you know, a Cisco ripoff, right, to this massive global, right, conglomerate that produces this huge range of services and technologies, right? And so, you know, they produce, I think that's part of it, right? So people don't realize how many things Huawei actually makes, right? You know, they make everything from, you know, wearables, personal fitness trackers and smartphones, you know, to network level devices, switches and routers and, you know, 5G base stations, to technologies and stuff at the global level as well, fiber optic lines, you know, these sort of safe city surveillance systems, right? Integrations, undersea cables, right? And I think that's part of the issue, right? And the conversation about Huawei is it has moved so quickly, right? From a Chinese company with a relatively small market share, right? Back in the early 2000s, you know, over the past 15 years or so, to this just giant conglomerate with this unimaginable almost amount of data, this huge range of services. Be on top of all that, right? So you have this sort of dichotomy, right? You have this gigantic company, right, that offers this huge range of services and technologies, right, that we could debate about whether one corporate entity should have mm-hmm, access to mm-hmm. that much, right, data or technology to begin with. But, you know, and then you kind of layer on top of that a company that exists within this authoritarian state, People's Republic of China, that's run by the Communist Party, a company that's benefited from that repressive system, supported the authoritarian rule, and is pretty much intertwined with the success of that Communist Party government's policies. And you have all these different factors with Huawei as a company that are present with Huawei and in this particular time, right, that are not present in sort of other equivalent companies or maybe at other sort of equivalent times.
And that's kind of the crux of the debate that's going on, because, again, the Trump administration has come down pretty hard on U.S. companies and allies and companies in allied countries saying, you know, if you're using Huawei infrastructure, Huawei network and routing gear, Huawei surveillance cameras, what have you, that poses a risk. And we as the U.S. government don't want to be doing business with you or, you know, connecting our networks to yours, as it were. The counter response has always been kind of prove it. You know, what evidence do you have that Huawei is operating on behalf of the Communist Party, the PLA? You sort of make the point that the proof is kind of besides the point, and that, again, given the environment in which not only Huawei as a company, but its individual employees operate, which is this, you know, authoritarian one-party state, that it's irrelevant whether there's evidence or not, because at the end of the day, the Chinese government comes knocking and says, we want you to do this. We know that both the company and its individual employees will do what the state tells them to do.
Yeah, I think it's that. So we take that approach, but also the kind of how you quantify risk approach, right? So whether or not Huawei technologies and services are acceptable for you to use, right, as a person or you in the corporate sense, depends on the risk, right, that you're willing to absorb from either potential Chinese military or intelligence espionage, potential for intellectual property theft. Mm-hmm. And I think that there are, frankly, enough examples of Huawei cooperation and complicity with the Chinese government at this point. So if we start off with one, right, we have that report from the British media where the CIA, right, was cautioning its British, you know, counterparts that Huawei had taken money from the PLA and Chinese national security entities. So that's one. You have Huawei involved with the repressive security measures in Xinjiang, out in western China, Xinjiang province, in which they are working with the Ministry of Public Security and others to repress an entire race of people out there, right? Providing technology to enable that. You know, they are part of China's Belt and Road Initiative, right? Which is sort of larger development program, right? Which is a technology aspect, and Huawei is intimately and expensively mm-hmm. tied into that. Right, receives government funding, right, to enable all of these preferential projects. So the sort of prove it, right, is like looking for something that I think we're already past, right? To say, right, or to argue at this point that the success of Huawei is not intimately involved with the success of some, you know, Chinese foreign policy goals at this point, it just doesn't measure up anymore, you know, if you look at the whole data picture.
Right. And as you point out, much of this is tied in with China's very aggressive economic development in their region, this kind of Belt and Road Initiative, which spans, you know, I don't know, dozens of countries, all the way from the, you know, Middle East and Africa, all the way to Europe. And, you know, a lot of that is about making investments in technology and connectivity, fiber optic cables, as well as the infrastructure to support that. And China's putting a lot of money and effort behind it. That's all good for commercial development, but also does introduce the risk of this foreign government having access to critical data within these countries. The U.S. is saying, just don't do it. Don't use this gear. But is that really an option when, you know, again, China's there offering investment and development, you know, using domestic companies in the same way that the U.S. did, you know, 40 or 50 years ago with the likes of, you know, General Electric and IBM and others? Is it enough to just say, don't trust these vendors when again, there's an offer there with cash behind it?
Again, it depends on who you talk to. But I think the argument we make, right, and that I've always believed is it's one of your risk threshold, right? And there are all companies out there, right, that are also installing, if we say 5G, right, or installing fiber optic lines or undersea cables. There are other companies out there doing it. It's just maybe they're not, you know, knocking on your front door, right, if you're an African telecom, for example. And, you know, it's about that particular entity, right, weighing the risks and benefits of buying Huawei solutions. So the benefits are obviously, right, in some cases, it's significantly cheaper, right? They have Huawei possesses a good 5G solution. Technology is good. The service they provide is good. But with that, right, comes the sort of tail, right, the negative tail. And that's where, you know, the rest of the risk calculation, you know, must come into effect, right? What level do you, either as a company or a country or an individual or a company, right, want to be involved in, you know, China's global push, right, to become an international telecommunications, you know, giant, right, and player? And what role will your data and your company, right, have in that larger strategic objective? And everybody will have different answers to that question. The U.S. government answer to that question is zero, right? The risk tolerance, right, for U.S. government, the Trump administration, you know, for Chinese involvement in telecoms is zero, right? And that's what they hope, right? Our allies will also, you know, adopt, but that might not be the risk threshold for the Brits, for example, you know, in the UK, right? They have a different risk tolerance. And so that's how we like to look at it.
But right now, companies are really, they are dealing with two black and white offers. On the one hand, Washington saying, if you use Huawei, we will not connect with you, do business with you as a U.S. government. On the other, now you have China summoning these technology vendors to, you know, Beijing and saying, you know, if you take part in this boycott that Washington is calling for, we will not do business with you. And we will, we will erect barriers for your technology in China and exact other types of punishment on you. And you have, you know, private companies kind of caught in the middle of these two things. So nobody seems to be saying, well, it's a sliding scale based on your risk. It's a very black and white offer on both sides.
Well, I think it's maybe, well, I still think of it as a sliding scale. And I'll say that because, you know, there are still significant impediments to business, doing business, right, in China. You know, there is not an equivalent. You can't just enter the Chinese market, right, as an American or a British company on your own, right? You need to partner in some way or fashion with a Chinese company, right? Either through a partnership or a joint venture, right? That involves, you know, ceding some of your ownership, right? And sometimes your technology and intellectual property, right, to your Chinese partner. So I think, you know, it's not necessarily the one or the other choice, because the reality is that it was never like entering, you know, the United States or a US market, right, for US or Western companies in China anyway, right? So there were already barriers that many companies were having a significant time overcoming, right, to entry into the Chinese market especially the technology market. And I think I would also argue that, you know, from a technology perspective, Chinese companies have developed a lot of their own indigenous solutions, right? Indigenous platforms that are so widely used and adopted, you know, among Chinese speaking users that, you know, there's a question as to how big the market actually is, right, for any of a sort of Western social media or technology platforms. So I guess my counter to that would be, sure, like maybe on the surface, it seems kind of like an equivalent choice. But just from my perspective, you know, the way I see it, it's not an equivalency, but companies certainly are in an extremely difficult position, right? And they are having to kind of portray themselves, right? Or try to not portray themselves as standing on one side or the other.
You point out, and there's certainly been other news coverage of this, you know, the point of the spear for Huawei and to a lot of these countries, particularly in a developing world, Africa and elsewhere, are these video surveillance cameras that are used for public safety and also law enforcement / social control. That's certainly how they are used within China. And this has been a big export of the company and the country, this notion of surveillance with an eye to really pretty authoritarian controls on people's free movement, free association, free speech, and so on. Talk a little bit about how that potentially could be a big risk for these countries and for, you know, just the spread and of democratic values, including, you know, freedom of speech and freedom of association.
Right. So I think when you look at it from a technology perspective, right, what Huawei and other Chinese companies in the sphere are offering is this sort of broad integrated solution, right? I think Huawei actually uses the terms omnipresent sensing, right, and big data solutions, where they're kind of developing technologies and promising to integrate all of these extremely disparate, right, data sources, you know, for the purposes of, you know, safety or security or whatever. So we're talking about everything from what they, you know, call business intelligence, right, social media, flight reservation systems, you know, emergency 911 calls, case management systems, database, video surveillance, right? You know, so the technology, right, required to, you know, make searchable and integrate all of these different types of data, it's extremely complicated. And to offer that as a solution is concerning, right, I think from a privacy and democratic values space, because one, right, Huawei will say they don't participate in how the technology is used, right, or implemented, right, once they sell it. But the testing ground, right, the beta where this is used is on, you know, the Chinese domestic population, right, within China. So, you know, these companies know how it's being used, right? They know how it can be integrated. And certainly, you know, there are some countries who are adopting these solutions that are on the less democratic side of the scale. There are other countries that are on the more democratic side of the scale, right? But I think what it provides is this easy access to a suite of information at any one given time where it's so easy to slip, easy to over-search, right? Easy to link up data streams, right? Videos and social media and flight reservations and case management systems for, you know, either minor offenses, right? Or political offenses or crimes that are offenses in one country, but on another. And, you know, Huawei, this is a large part of an expanding part of their business, you know, in which they explicitly play on, you know, trying to provide security, right, and support for police forces around the world, right, but can very easily slip into the kind of Orwellian monitoring, right, and the sort of, you know, over response to minor crimes or, again, you know, the politicization of crimes. So it's not the technology itself, right? Sure, the technology itself integrates, right, all of these data streams and makes them searchable, right, for this omnipresent monitoring, right? It's the application of that technology and the possible, like you were saying, sharing of the data back with China.
So I'm going to offer up the standard false equivalence argument, or at least equivalence argument, which is the person who's invariably going to say, well, you know, the United States government has been doing the exact same thing forever and ever via domestic companies, again, Cisco, GE. We know from Edward Snowden that they did interdiction on Cisco gear, and God knows what the NSA and CIA have been up to, you know, using the platform of U.S.-based telecommunications and multinationals. So this is just China doing the same thing, and their actions are no more good or bad than those done by the U.S. government.
Yeah, I would dispute that, I would say. So if we're talking about lawful intercept, right? So one of the sort of parts we get into with this piece is how, you know, setting up base stations in underserved areas of the globe, right? Central Asia or the Middle East, right? Impacts how internet traffic gets routed around the globe, right? And therefore, you know, which country will be able to leverage their kind of lawful intercept laws upon the traffic that transits, right? That specific, you know, exchange or those cables, right? So, you know, we talk a little bit about the legal regimes, for example, in the United Kingdom or the United States, right? Both of which have the, you know, give their intelligence services, right? The ability to, you know, with a warrant, right? And through a legal system, you know, collect, you know, internet traffic, right? That transits their particular geography, right? That's the key, right? And the argument that I would make is the key distinction from what sort of the West and what Snowden disclosed, and what the West is sort of legally enables its intelligence services to do, and what China sort of legally and extrajudicially allows its intelligence and security services to
do. The difference being that we have a transparent legal system that is consistent, that operates according to, you know, precedent and laws, and that we all follow the laws, and as opposed to China.
Yes. So, right, if you would need to get a FISA, right, warrant, right, for an Intelligence Surveillance Act warrant, right, is a huge packet, right, and questions that need to be addressed and evidence that needs to be provided, right, to support the argument from either, say, the FBI or the NSA or whoever, right, that this particular person or this email selector, right, is one that deserves, right, and needs, right, the national security attention of, you know, the United States for these reasons, right, and it is a threat and it has to go through the court system. Those warrants, right, can be disputed, right, by the companies themselves, mm-hmm. and all that. In China, there is not that ability to challenge a warrant. They don't actually issue warrants, right, to their companies. There, for example, if you look at their censorship apparatus, right, the censorship apparatus is integrated with some of the large technology companies in China. The companies proactively censor terms, for example. Based on,
and we've all spoken to people who have had this happen,
right?
You know, even in chats with their family and stuff, just words dropping out,
right.
And you know, it's
right.
it's creepy stuff. Anyway, yeah,
yeah. So that sort of says it for you, right? That system is already well integrated in China from a censorship perspective, and it's integrated from an intelligence and security perspective as well, and you know, the legal regime, right, from the past sort of 3 to 5 years also makes it incumbent upon individuals and companies in China to proactively be cooperating with the intelligence services in China. Right? So there is no, you know, regime for which companies or individuals can challenge, right, a request from the Chinese government. And, you know, we see just from case after case, you know, in the United States court system, right, how the Chinese intelligence services use kind of coercive, right, or co-optive methodologies to just, if one level of, you know, management refuses a request, right, then they have all these other means, right, extrajudicial means, coercive means, you know, to get someone mm-hmm. either lower
sure.
or higher on the chain,
yeah.
right, to do what they want
right.
for them.
Threaten your family, right, et cetera,
right.
Threaten
and
retaliation.
And that's demonstrated, right. It's a demonstrated
right.
history.
And as you point out, I mean, one of the, you know, we can talk about this at the level of technology, but at a very high level, at the sort of 100,000 foot level, this is a battle of ideologies that's taking shape globally. And on the one hand, you know, is our Western countries, who are at least in theory championing the idea of democracy and democratic values of free expression, free association, freedom of religion, and so on, and yes, free trade. But that China might be gung-ho for trade and increased economic development, they are not fans of those democratic values.
Right. I mean, they are actually threatened by democratic values, right? Freedoms, speech, religion, assembly, right? Those are actual threats to the one-party system, you know, that China holds. And I guess I think the last thing I would sort of say is that it's we're not making a black and white argument that American technologies are great and or technology companies are great and freedom loving and Chinese technology companies are not, right? Because that's certainly not the case. There are other companies, you know, that we all as a society have to reckon with the questions, right, about datas and the sort of cross technology mm-hmm. risk and how sure. much data we want one company to have, right? But what's accelerating, it's accelerating this conversation for Huawei are these sort of two facts, right? One, they have such this broad range of products and services, right, that you almost can't escape your packets traveling over the internet, right, traveling over some type of Huawei infrastructure. And second, that they are a company within, right, the Chinese system, right, one-party authoritarian system that are threatened by these values, and that those two facts together are accelerating this discussion we're having, and why Huawei seems to be kind of the lightning rod for it is because they possess these two.
I guess putting yourself in the position of the developing nation that has China and Huawei knocking on their door and wanting to do big infrastructure, and then, you know, here's their maybe longtime ally or the global superpower of the United States saying, no, don't. Isn't it incumbent on the U.S. to have a counteroffer, to also have money and incentives on the door, to have companies that it does feel comfortable about, U.S. or otherwise, there ready to offer a similar package? I mean, the types of development China is offering to countries, you point out Pakistan in your report, is enormous. It's highways and telecommunications infrastructure and special economic zones, to cultivate and nurture new companies. It's, you know, it is just comprehensive aid that is desperately needed. Washington seems to be kind of huffing and puffing, and this is kind of the zeitgeist right now, and making empty threats, but not offering anything in return, anything material to these countries. Is that really going to cut it?
Because my personal opinion is no, right? I mean, the United States government is forcing, right, these smaller companies and countries, right, to make decisions without giving them, you know, the alternate side, right, by saying, we recommend you not use Huawei, and here are the consequences, right, if you do. However, right, we don't have a teed-up alternative for you, right? We don't have another development plan that rivals the Belt and Road Initiative, like you said.
Yeah.
Right, one that supports democratic values, right? Most, you know, even the EU, right, who, you know, maybe is ahead from a funding perspective, right, does fund some of those projects, doesn't have the volume, right, the amount of capital that China has. So you're completely right that we're sort of stuck on Huawei, right? But the conversation is much larger, right? And it's about how do these countries, right, modernize their infrastructure, their economies, right, bring the living wages, right, of their populations up, right, accelerate their development, right, without using, right, these huge yeah. infrastructure programs like Belt and Road, or using the technologies provided by companies like Huawei, and also incurring the significant potential negatives, right, over the long term.
Yeah. It's like China's all carrot and we're all stick, right?
Right.
I mean, they're there offering economic development, and, you know, I'm sure these countries aren't stupid. They know that, you know, there may be more in the small print of these agreements than they'd like. But we're offering nothing. We're offering threats. And it just seems to me, with, you know, I don't have a degree in foreign relations or international relations, that that's probably not a great recipe to get countries to do what you want.
Right. But I mean, again, it's also that risk threshold, right? So not installing, you know, undersea cables or 5G networks in the next 2 to 3 years, right? And waiting yep. for the sort of freedom-loving Western equivalent, right, to come along.
If it comes along, right? Who knows?
If it comes along, right? There's a risk in waiting for that versus the risks in installing them now using Chinese money and Chinese technologies and what that will occur over time, right? So that is certainly a decision that they're making, right? Countries can make the decision to wait, right, for a Western alternative, right? Your point is certainly well taken that we don't know, right, what that will be or when it's coming. May not be on any scale similar to the Belt and Road Initiative, of course, but it is still a risk choice, right, that those countries are making.
Okay, final question is, the tough one. What should companies do if they're reading your report? What's the takeaway? I guess it's to, assess your risk and weigh the pros and cons. But honestly, what would your recommendations be to the, CISO or CIO or CEO who's looking at this report?
First and foremost, right, know your vertical, right, and your sector, right? So, Huawei has a past, whether we like to acknowledge it or not, a legally documented past of engaging in intellectual property theft, right? Whether for us, what we believe is on its own behalf, right? If you look at the sort of legal documentation, that's been documented, right? So know your vertical, right? Know the industry that you're in, right? Is a competing industry with some of the kind of national long-term development objectives, right, in China. And if you are a direct competitor, my advice would be not to use Huawei technologies or services in the core and critical parts of your networks, right? Protect yourself as a company or intellectual property where you can. I mean, I think you can do that, by at this point, keeping Huawei technologies from the real core parts of your networks. You want a sort of a secondary, right, basis away from that. I hate to say that, know your risk, but, know your risk, right? You cannot, it's not possible for any entity, even the United States government, right, to escape Huawei technologies and services, completely, right? So understand, that where you have subsidiaries or where you choose to focus resources, geographically, right, could have higher instances of Huawei gear, right, or interest from Chinese intelligence and security services. I mean, weigh that into the decisions that you're making about what business products, services, right, teams you're engaging in those areas. I mean, what you're willing to lose, to be honest. So that would be the bottom line, I think. And with individuals, right, this is less of a Huawei question, more of a whole, how much of your data do you want to be in the hands of one company? Type of, sort of personal risk question.
Looking ahead 5 or 10 years, do you think the U.S. government's efforts to warn about Huawei will have impacted the company's growth? Or do you think, again, absent a alternative, probably not?
Yeah, I think, personally, I would probably, my own personal forecast, right, is that if the West, right, cannot present an equivalent development project or technology solutions, right, at the same cost as Huawei, that, over the 5 to 10 years, we will kind of become bifurcated, right? There will be countries and companies who choose to use Huawei technologies either for ideological reasons or for cost reasons. And unless the United States and the West can provide an equivalent, right, service or a program, right, that you'll kind of have these two sort of bifurcated areas of the globe, right? I think we can still avoid it. We could still come to, the U.S. government could still, come to an agreement, right, with the Chinese government to increase transparency and work together on certain issues. But it looks like we're kind of moving away from that right now.
Priscilla Moriarty, it's always a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, Paul, for having me.
Priscilla Moriarty is the Director of Strategic Threat Development at the firm Recorded Future.